Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Welcome to tonight's program, Now and Then, in conversation with Ambassador James Hormel. This series, conceived by Dr. Carol Fleming and chaired by Stephen Sewer, Now and Then examines all aspects of life from World War II until the present and 10 years into the future. Everything in this series is open for examination, reminiscing, and discussion. We invite everyone to participate with us in creating this wonderful archive of our shared history. Within this special context, it is our pleasure and privilege to welcome the inaugural guest, Ambassador James Hormel. He is an astute and articulate thought leader, a generous philanthropist, a stalwart citizen of San Francisco, and a pioneer through history, and a trailblazer personally for many of us. James Catherwood Hormel was born on New Year's Day in 1933 in Austin, Minnesota. He is the grandson of George Hormel, who founded Hormel Foods. Earning his BA in history, Mr. Hormel is a graduate of Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania and went on to the University of Chicago School of Law, where he later served as Dean of Admissions. He was married in 1955 and divorced several years later. He is a proud father of five children and enjoys good relations with his family. He lived in New York for many years, then moved to Kauai, and moved to San Francisco in 1976. One of the very first board members on the Human Rights Campaign, James Hormel became a prominent voice for equality, inclusion, human rights, and gay rights. He was named to the United States delegation to the UN Human Rights Commission in 1995. 2 years later, he was an alternate delegate for the United States in the UN General Assembly. In 1996, he made a landmark donation to the San Francisco Public Library, which led to the creation of the James C. Hormel Gay and Lesbian Center, which today houses the largest collection of LGBT literature in the world. In 1997, President Bill Clinton nominated Mr. Hormel to be United States Ambassador to Luxembourg. A lengthy and vicious but groundbreaking political battle ensued. Eventually, Mr. Hormel was appointed to his post and served as ambassador to Luxembourg from mid-1999 through the end of 2000. He is the first openly gay man to represent the United States as an ambassador. Ambassador Hormel is a great supporter of the arts, the cultural institutions of this city, AIDS research foundations, and gay rights institutions. He's also a historian and an author. We are proud of that he is, most of all, a San Franciscan and our friend. Welcome, Ambassador Hormel.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. And you can tell, if you figure that I was born in 1933, that I qualify for both then and now.
Ambassador, in 1998, you were quoted with one of your favorite sayings, saying, "Define yourself or risk being defined by others." How do you define yourself?
I have to look at various aspects of my life to come to a conclusion. And the conclusion I would like to come to is that I am a caring human being who would like to see, who would like to leave this world a better place than I found it, and who would like, in that sense, to make the quality of life on the planet better for everyone, not just for a select group. I have, as you mentioned, I have five children. I have 14 grandchildren. I have a great granddaughter. And these are people who help to identify me because I care so much for their well-being. And they cause me to think about what I'm doing here and elsewhere to either make life better or to damage the climate in which we live. I mean, this world is our living room, and we need to treat it with respect.
Now, in many respects, elements of your story are common to young achievers everywhere, going to a great college, going to law school, being professionally recognized as dean of a prestigious institution. But today, as we celebrate Pride Month here in San Francisco, you are seen as a gay legend. Let's start at the beginning. Can you tell us, when did you think of yourself as gay?
I guess the question could be phrased in one of two ways. When did I first perceive that I had feelings that were different from the norm? And when was I willing to think of myself as gay? And there is probably a generation's worth of time between those two, because I knew by the time I was 10 or 11 or 12 that I had those different feelings, which I couldn't really identify clearly. And when I was able to identify them, I had already given into social pressures. I had married a person with whom I was in love and whom I still love dearly. And it may be confusing for some to grasp that it's possible to have that kind of love and to have these inexorable feelings which drew me to same-sex relationships.
Well, today there are LGBT families that are being formed every day, and children grow up knowing that their parents are gay. You have a unique situation of coming out to your children. How was that?
By the time I started coming out to my children, I had already begun the process with my brothers and with close friends. So with each step, I think it became a little bit easier. My eldest daughter was, I believe, 13 when I first talked with her. And I tried to speak privately with each of my children as they became around 12 or 13 years old, although I'm sure that, you know, once I had talked with Allison, the word spread down the line. I was fortunate because they were positively responsive.
And that bears out in history because you, during your nomination battle, which we will get into later, your wife and your son spoke out publicly on your behalf.
Yeah.
And that's an extraordinary feat for families to step into a line of fire like that, especially so when the whole country is involved in that. What was that like for them to step into your life as a public figure?
They wanted to do it. I actually did not ask. My ex-wife wrote a letter to Senator Lott imploring him to meet with me and to allow my nomination to come to a vote in the Senate. And she said, among other things, I can't think of anyone who knows his values better than I do. My son was angry. My son was, in fact, rather furious that things were being said about me, which were patently distorted to make me appear to be a different kind of person than the person he knows. And so he wrote an op-ed piece, which was published here and elsewhere. Both of these pieces came into the hands of Frank Rich at the New York Times, who wrote a very powerful piece himself. Actually, he wrote two.
Let's go back a little bit, back to the 1960s. And I know you're an avid student of history, especially San Francisco history. So I want to go over some of the early facts where San Francisco led the nation, as we always do. For example, in 1961, Jose Sarria entered the race for San Francisco supervisor, becoming the first ever openly gay person to run for office. Astoundingly, he received over 5,600 votes, an early sign that the gay community could become a powerful political bloc. Now, what impact, if any, did that have on you, and did it plant seeds for later political action or political realization on your part?
Well, it didn't directly to me, because back in 1961, I was living in Chicago. I was really not very much aware of what was happening here. I was in the middle of my own transition. I had left the practice of law and just started working as dean of students and dean of admissions at the law school. I had been at that time invited to run for Congress to replace a retiring congresswoman in the district where I lived at that time. This is rather a lengthy and amusing story. I decided against running because I was so intimidated by a book that had come out recently called Advise and Consent, which involved all kinds of horrors about a young senator who was exposed as a result of an incident during World War II to all kinds of threats of blackmail and other things, and involved a suicide. And I thought, I can't face that. The amusing part of the story is that the person who actually did run and won was Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, I think the facts speak for themselves on that one.
So what Jose was doing here didn't affect me at the time. It affected San Francisco greatly. And as I came to know and love the city, I came to know and love Jose, too.
Another example of San Francisco first comes to mind. 3 years before the Stonewall riots in New York, here in San Francisco on a New Year's Eve, there was a riot of a known sort, which was the first known act of collective violent resistance to queer people being put down in the United States. What happened, and what was your reaction when you heard about this?
Well, once again, I heard about it several years after the fact, but it did predate Stonewall by about 4 years, and it happened on New Year's Eve. There was a drag ball in a place, I think it was California Hall. The police were prepared to raid the event. They stationed plainclothesmen outside the hall. There was a table inside where several young volunteers, I think they were all lawyers, sat to screen people and keep those who were not a part of the group from getting into the ballroom. So the police outside started photographing the people who were going inside. There was one gentleman who, he was a very young Lutheran pastor. He went outside with his camera and started taking pictures of the police, taking pictures of them. Came back in, gave the film to a buxom young friend of his who stuffed the reels into her bosom and was petrified because she was standing there with the only known evidence of what was going on. Ultimately, there were arrests. And based on reports from the event, the city, the whole city was in an uproar over it. It was an enormous black eye for the police department, and I think that it really changed the atmosphere of San Francisco once and for all.
Now, before you moved to San Francisco, you lived for a number of years in New York and also in Kauai. And why did you move to Kauai from New York? It just seems to me like a complete rejection almost of a certain life.
Well, in a sense, it was a rejection, I guess. It wasn't intended that way. I had hoped to do some writing. I was very distracted by all of the goings-on in New York, and I wanted a place that would provide me with more seclusion. But also, after Stonewall, the political atmosphere, especially in New York, changed quickly. Because after people recognized what a miracle had occurred there, and a political action group was formed, the people in the group immediately started fighting with each other. This is a pattern which I think people who have been involved in the LGBT movement will recognize. The fight led to a split, and here were two organizations suddenly who found it more interesting to argue between themselves than to move forward politically. And it was very frustrating. It was a frustrating experience. So when I left New York in 1973, that was more or less the atmosphere that I was leaving. I was disappointed. McGovern had just been very, very severely beaten. Yes. Nixon had been reelected, and the country seemed to be oblivious to some of the things which I thought were really critical human rights issues at the time. So I didn't miss leaving that behind for a few years.
So 4 years later, in the bicentennial year, you decide to leave Hawaii, which had to have been a bittersweet a decision. Why did you move to San Francisco with the whole world available to you? Why did you come to San Francisco?
Well, it's interesting. It's not at all what people might suspect. I had a long-distance relationship with someone who was living in Minneapolis at the time. And as a graphic artist, was looking for career opportunities. And there were really only three or four cities in North America that appealed to him in terms of job opportunities, San Francisco being one. And it was the one city where neither one of us knew anybody. I had one friend here, and he had one friend here. So we thought, well, let's find out what this place is really like.
You are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California on the topic of Now and Then in Conversation with Ambassador James Hormel. Well, you arrived in San Francisco in 1976 at the height of the free love movement. And although it was a time of freer sex then, what was gay life like from your perspective in the city in 1976?
Well, at that time, it was actually 77 when I moved here, the district, which is called the Castro now, which is Eureka Valley, was in the process of becoming gay-dominated. People who were moving out, I think, were a little resentful that that their neighborhood was changing as rapidly as it was. But it was. It was changing very rapidly. And San Francisco itself was showing a very welcome face. Within a year of the time I moved here, Harvey Milk was elected to the Board of Supervisors. This was during district elections. It might not have happened if we had had citywide elections at the time. But it did happen, and it caused an enormous stir. There were very sympathetic politicians who were in positions of power in the city. When Dianne Feinstein became mayor, under the most unfortunate circumstances, she made a great point of selecting individuals from the LGBT constituency to serve in her various administrations and to serve in very high positions. So things were changing rapidly. Meanwhile, Anita Bryant had scored her victory in Miami, and there was an initiative that was introduced in California called Prop 6, which would have prevented gay people from teaching in the public school system, among other things. Prop 6 was polling very positively, and there was enormous concern about whether it could possibly be prevented from passing. So the effort was engaged both North and South, and the people who organized it were wise enough to realize that this was not something that the LGBT constituency could win on its own. The No on Six campaign was conducted relying very heavily on our non-gay allies. And incidentally, I see one here in the audience, Hadley Roth, who was deputy mayor under Dianne Feinstein for many years. Bert Pines, I believe, who was city attorney in Los Angeles at the time, was more or less in charge of the campaign. And the miracle happened. We defeated Prop 6.
Well, it was a great miracle. Now, that was in 1978. Then in 2000, Prop 22, which was a statute defining marriage as between a man and a woman, passed in California with 61% of the vote. Did you feel like everything that had been achieved in the defeat of Prop 6 had been undone by the passage of Proposition 22?
Well, I'm going to at least partly demur because I was not here at the time. I had been posted by then to Luxembourg, and I might fast forward for a moment because that posting took place, as I suppose you're going to ask me, under the most adverse circumstances, here, not there. When I arrived in Luxembourg, I discovered a country that was very eager to make me feel welcome. And I was really very proud of that kind of response. It couldn't have been better for me. Even though I had a relatively limited time there, it was much easier for me to begin working immediately with the government of Luxembourg because of their feelings toward the whole process. They, I believe, were resentful that the leaders in the United States Senate would have the audacity to say that I was an improper nominee for their country when they had already given their official approval to the nomination. And so when I arrived there, I got special attention, which I greatly appreciated, not only because it made me feel good, but because it made it easier for me to work. And here again, I'm casting an eye out into the audience, and I see with us tonight the consul of Luxembourg and his wife. Thanks for being here.
We're definitely going to get into the nomination battle, and also I have several questions that have already come in about Luxembourg, so we will be discussing it. In the realm of some things never change, here it is. We are now in 2008, and just like when Prop 6 could be back again, because we have another proposition on the California ballot in November 2008, this time to amend the California Constitution to ban marriage except between a man and a woman. Now, I know you have some thoughts on this, so please, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, until the Supreme Court decision, the recent Supreme Court decision here in California, I used to say at every given opportunity that we already have gay marriage in all 50 states, It's just a question of the gender of the couple. And I can't say that anymore here, at least now. But it really does sort of illustrate one of the follies of the issue, because we're really talking about equality, not marriage. We're talking about the opportunity for couples who love each other to marry and to get all of the benefits, social, psychological, and otherwise emotional, from that relationship. As it stands now, the federal government officially prevents people from receiving something over 1,100 specific benefits from the federal government alone. And I think a lot of our married friends don't realize that fact.
So there will be a huge fight in California at the same time that an election for a president is going on. And how will you spend your political capital?
Well, obviously, I'm very concerned about this issue. And I would like to do my very best to make the effort to educate the voters in California to see that, among other things, if they are really concerned about the sanctity of marriage, then they should start with divorce. If they are really concerned that marriage is only for procreation, then they should consider the possibility of screening everybody for fertility. If they're really concerned about how their marriage would be affected by two people of the same sex being married, they ought to consider my very dear friends, Phyllis Lyon and Del Martin, who at the ages of 87 and 84 recently got married. And so far as I know, the sun still comes up in the morning.
And Phyllis and Del are a great example of how far things have come as opposed to the proposition process in California, which seems to be eternal.
They've been together for 53 years. This, incidentally, today, would be my 53rd wedding anniversary.
Wow. One of the most exciting gifts that I think you've ever made to San Francisco was in 1996 when you made a $500,000 gift to the San Francisco Public Library to establish the LGBT collection that is now named after you. Of all the things that you could have given to, why would you give it to a public library?
I'll try to make it a short answer.
No, you don't have to make it short at all.
The San Francisco Public Library was moving into new facilities. Those facilities were extremely expensive, and there was no money left to furnish the new building. So there was a very elaborate fundraising campaign, which achieved about half its goal and then stalled. So people who were conducting the campaign were very concerned about how to move it forward. And Steve Coulter, who was at that time president of the San Francisco Library Commission, came up with an idea, which he shared with a small group of us, to create what he called affinity groups who would help to sponsor sections of the library where they would find supportive materials for their particular group. So he spoke to a number of gay men and lesbians, I think only maybe a dozen of us, gathered in his home one night. And when we left, I was so incredibly captivated by the idea that I started thinking about how this could be brought into being. And I had never made any kind of a gift at that, you know, anywhere near that level before. And the thought of it frightened me. So I spent a good deal of time in the next few weeks examining what might happen, whether that would be the best use of those funds, whether the resulting facility would indeed be available to the general public, whether the city would commit itself indelibly to maintaining that that facility. We actually created some documents to assure that if at some time in the future the city administration, the gay constituency, lost favor with the city administration, that it, the library collection would continue as is. I figured that at least a part of the contribution could be used as an endowment for future development. When the gift was announced, I was stunned at the response. People from all over the country were extremely enthusiastic about it. We had a goal of $1,500,000 to raise for that facility. And a few months into the process, there was a fundraising dinner scheduled at the Hyatt Regency. I was out of town and returned the afternoon of the dinner. I went home from the airport, put on my black tie, went to the Hyatt Regency, and as I walked in at the ground level, I looked at the room next to the entrance in the porte cochere and noticed that it was set up for maybe 300 people, and my heart sank. I thought, oh my goodness, is that all they're going to have for this dinner? I thought it would be, you know, somewhat stronger than that. I went up to the atrium where there was a cocktail party going on, where it was so extremely lively that I could hear it two floors down on the escalator. And I realized that somehow my guess was wrong. Then I discovered that the room I had seen was the overflow room. That they had planned for 1,200 and they actually had 1,500 people coming to this dinner. The dinner raised over $800,000, more than half of the goal, and it was the only fundraiser that we needed to have. Over 2,000 people, in fact, it may be close to 3,000, contributed to the project. So, and all of those names are engraved in the library. Now, that it's in a public facility, I think, sort of caps it, because it does mean that this collection is available not only in San Francisco, but to libraries around the world through the internet and through the connecting systems.
It is a remarkable achievement, especially, I mean, even today, $800,000 in one night is amazing. What has been your role, if any, in running or selecting any of the day-to-day matters in the James C. Hormel Gay and Lesbian Center at the San Francisco Public Library?
Well, it's been absolutely zero. In my opinion, and in the library's opinion, I'm sure, inappropriate for me to exercise that kind of influence.
Now, that's a stunning answer because, as we know, fast forward now to 1997, when you are nominated to be ambassador to Luxembourg by President Clinton, there were binders, I remember, floating around about the library collections, saying that they had been selected by you, and some of them were characterized as being pornographic, etc. And yet you had nothing to do with that thing. When you were nominated, did you have a sense of how tough the process was going to be?
Well, yes, I had a sense. But I had a completely different sense. I had assumed that I would be challenged directly by people who had already made it clear that they didn't want to have gay people, gay men and lesbians, in public service. And that the battle would take place over issues that had to do with my qualifications. And that was not what happened.
Let's talk about your qualifications. You were on the United Nations Human Rights Commission. You also served as an alternate delegate representing the United States of America in the General Assembly. So for someone with those credentials, certainly an ambassadorship is foreseeable. Your nomination sails through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee by a vote of 16-2. So far, so good. And only two senators were opposed to you, Jesse Helms and John Ashcroft. Coming out of the committee, did you feel good? I mean, you have characterized how you felt about the process, but did you have any idea that there was going to be this rump group made up of three senators, Senator Inhofe, Hutchinson, and Smith, that would lead such a vicious battle against you?
No, I didn't. I think that the fact that the committee had approved me, that Jesse Helms had let the committee vote, even though he voted against me, made me feel that that I had taken the last major step. And it was a big surprise when I found out that senators had put a hold on my nomination.
Something like 60 senators were actually waiting to be able to vote on your nomination, and they were not allowed to because of Senator Lott. And during that time period, you and your family and your partner at the time came under scrutiny that not even presidential candidates or their families have come under in terms of how vicious it was, how personal it was, how distorting it was. Now we have the term for it called swift voting, and I guess they were just kind of practicing on you for that. How does one cope personally with that sort of distortion of your character, of your record, and your relationships?
Well, one of the problems for me was that I was not allowed to speak out about it. The State Department, through its wisdom and through experience, advised me that by speaking out, I would merely draw focus to the issues. I would not be changing anybody's mind, and that it was better for me not to try to address them publicly. There was a contemporary example, Bill Weld, who had just been nominated as an ambassador and who decided that he was going to take Jesse Helms on. And it was a battle which he very clearly lost. So given that example, I found that the only way that I could get out responses to these ridiculous charges was through others who would speak on my behalf. And I was blessed to have a champion in the Senate, happened to be a Republican, Gordon Smith from Oregon, who wrote a letter to me in which he asked me a series of questions saying, these charges have been made against you, how do you respond to them? And through that vehicle, I was able to give clear answers.
Do you see your nomination and appointment as ambassador as appeasement by President Clinton to the LGBT community for his handling of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell issue several years earlier?
I don't think so, because I really think that President Clinton in 1993 did what he thought was the best possible thing he could do. He really was determined to end the prohibition of service in military forces of gay men and lesbians. And I think that he miscalculated and took a fallback position with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And I don't think that he regarded it as something that required some sort of appeasement. So if you ask me why he stuck with me, I can't answer the question, but I don't think that was the reason.
Well, happily, you did become ambassador, so here's a question. What is it like to be an ambassador? What do you do? Do people just call you Your Excellency all day? Do you pick out which sash you're going to wear?
My son came to visit me midway through my term there, and he picked up on that very quickly and started calling me Excellence. I didn't stop him. But it's interesting. The position has evolved. Technically, the ambassador is the personal representative of the President of the United States in that particular country. And the embassy is his fiefdom, which is virtually absolute. In the olden days, when communications went by ship, even before wireless services, the ambassador played a really critical role in whichever country he appeared as the representative. And the role was largely diplomatic. Today, with instant communications, ambassadors usually take their orders directly from Washington. And if there is a policy issue, there will be an exchange back and forth, and the ambassador's perspective, I think, is very valuable, but in the end, it is not the ultimate decision, the ultimate word. On the other hand, what an ambassador does often is to represent the commercial interests of the United States in the country where he or she is designated to serve. And those interests are critical and vast, and representing them requires a considerable amount of integrity, because you have to judge not only whether you are giving favor to a company over another company, but whether you are really serving the best interests of the United States by your representation. So,
well, I have direct orders here from the audience to ask you some questions. But first, you are listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California on the topic of Now and Then in Conversation with Ambassador James Hormel. So I'm going to ask you these questions, and we'll kind of go quickly if you don't mind.
Do my best.
Mr. Ambassador, please tell me a little about Luxembourg. What did you like best about it, and what did you dislike about that country?
I disliked the small amount of time that I spent there. Luxembourg is charming and beautiful, but it's also central to Western Europe. Luxembourg was one of the founders of the European Union, what we now know as the European Union, and it was one of the charter members of NATO. Luxembourg was a country which had been deprived of its identity during World War II. Most people don't realize that the country was actually annexed. It wasn't just occupied. It was annexed, and when the American armed forces went into Luxembourg in 1944, they were regarded specially because they were restoring the national identity to this very important but very small nation. General Patton is buried in Luxembourg, and that in itself is an interesting story. He was killed in an accident in Germany at the end of 1945. And when his widow asked that he be buried in the military cemetery at Hamm, the United States government declined, because they said that the people in that cemetery were all killed in combat and that he was not entitled to be buried there. So the widow went to the Grand Duchess and told her of her plight and said, "My husband wanted to be with his troops, and my government is not permitting it." And the Grand Duchess said, "Leave it to me." She went to the American military high command and said, "I understand that you will not permit General George S. Patton to be buried with his troops in the military cemetery in Luxembourg. And I just want you to know that if you will not allow him to be buried there, we will bury him in the National Cathedral." Needless to say, rules were changed. That is an example of the wonderful grit and also diplomatic verve that one finds in this country, which is located smack between Germany and France, and regards itself rightly as sort of the arbiter of relations between those two very important countries.
We have several questions on people who would like to be an ambassador themselves. Should sexual orientation or any other demographic classification be a valid reason for someone to be appointed to an important foreign relations post? For example, would it work for someone who is LGBT to be ambassador to Egypt? Or could there be an effective female ambassador to Iran?
Well, these are very important decisions, I think. And they would be made by the president taking into consideration the government with which he was dealing. And I think that in some cases it would not be wise to make those kinds of nominations. It would not be the correct diplomatic move. And probably the country in question would not give its approval to that nomination. Aside from the vetting process, prospective ambassadors are submitted to the country to whom they may be sent for what is called agrément, or the official approval of that country. And without agrément, it's very, very unlikely that a person would be nominated.
Here's a multiple choice question. Which had the most effect on you? A, the legal system saying you were a criminal. B, the church saying you were going to hell. C, the military saying you were a security risk. Or D, the psychology establishment saying you were sick.
Well, I think that perhaps the most vile of those is the last one. That's the one, I think, which probably had the most deleterious effect on my generation. It was only in 1973 that the American Psychiatric Association changed its definition so that homosexuality was no longer classified as an illness. And so far as the others are concerned, you live to deal with them. Say them again. Let's have them again.
Well, I'm going to ask it a little bit differently then. How has homophobia affected your life, if any, and how is public homophobia different today than it was 50 years ago?
Well, the last part of that is that it's much more public. In 50 years ago, or let's say 60 years ago, nobody talked about sex of any kind. It was not a subject for polite conversation at any level. And today, everybody talks about it all the time. It is blatantly flaunted in television commercials and, you know, virtually everything you look at. And still the most popular insult in a high school is faggot or dyke. And so those terms are cast about very freely, and they are just as hurtful today as they were 60 years ago, and perhaps even more so, because you hear them all the time today and you didn't hear them then.
What do you think are the major challenges in the next 5 years for counseling psychologists to work with the LGBT community, especially the youth in San Francisco?
I think that young people generally are somewhat intimidated in the coming out process of rejection. And perhaps much less so today than in earlier times. Their fears are enforced by laws that allow for rejection. People don't realize that there is no federal statute that protects against job discrimination, for example, on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. No protection whatever at the federal level. It's stunning to me, absolutely stunning. And there have been proposals for almost two decades to establish those laws, but they still don't get passed.
Let's talk about that, because prejudice and retribution have not, of course, gone away because of recent California decisions that have been favorable to larger society. And contrasting that with what you have just said, long-standing views in many European nations, such as and also Australia and New Zealand, are quite different. You were welcomed in Luxembourg. What can the United States do to harmonize itself with the viewpoints of the rest of the world?
Well, of course, those viewpoints vary dramatically, as you pointed out in an earlier question about Egypt and Iran. But the United States could, for example, conform to the standards of the European Union, which requires every member of the Union to allow lesbians and gay men to serve in their military forces. The claim in this country is something to do with unit cohesion and all of that, which gives a lie to the fact that every member of those EU countries in NATO has members of the NATO forces who may be gay. And United States service members are obliged to serve with them. And I don't think that we've seen any particular disasters among our NATO forces as a result of that. So, you know, it's essential hypocrisy that we're dealing with.
Who do you admire most in the world of international relations today?
The first person who comes to mind is not officially a diplomat, and that is Bishop Desmond Tutu. I think that he has spoken out so clearly, so forcefully, in such a heartfelt manner on all issues of social justice that I just can't think of a person whose word serves the world better than his.
We're switching gears from the international to the local. When was the first time that you heard or understood the term transgendered? And are you in support of full transgender rights?
I don't really remember the first time I heard the term, which has... you said transgendered and then transgender, and transgender is the term that is politically correct today. There were many instances in my youth when I knew of people who liked to cross-dress. But the first transgender person I met was in 1974, 75, I think it was. And that was Renee Richards. And it was very clear to me that Dr. Richards took a course that was appropriate for her. And I could not imagine thinking of her in any term other than Renee Richards. Since then, I've known a large number of people, including someone here in San Francisco who comes from my hometown of Austin, Minnesota, who is a man here and was a woman there, who is, I think, a wonderful example of a public citizen. And I can't imagine anyone who knows him who would deny that.
What factors do you use to guide your philanthropy? In other words, how do you decide who you say yes to when they ask for a donation and why?
Well, the problem presupposes the biggest issue, I think, for all philanthropists, which is the infinite demands and the finite supply. So you have to make some very, very difficult decisions, which means you have to set some very narrow guidelines. And mine are narrowing, because when I started, I didn't have a realization of the incredible demands that would be coming to me. So I've chosen to focus on social justice issues, not just among LGBT organizations, but across the board, because I feel that that for my interests, those issues are, if properly addressed, most likely to change the course of events in our country.
Here's another personal question. What advice would you give to a young LGBT person moving to San Francisco today?
Well, I think that that person would be able to find a community that is welcoming, and that it would be a mistake for that person to do what was done a generation ago, which was to ghettoize. I don't like the term because it has so many negative implications. But many people who came here 20, 25 years ago were coming from communities where they directly experienced hate and intolerance, even within their own families. And it served them to find themselves in a group of people where they felt welcome and at home. But I think in today's San Francisco, this is generally true. When I see Hadley and Susie Roth here, I think about 1979, when Dianne Feinstein was running for election. She had fallen into the position of being mayor, and when she was running for election, the campaign was bitter, and it reflected very much on this new constituency that was beginning to feel its power. And CBS sent a film crew, which spent about 2 months in San Francisco recording events that they claimed would be put into a documentary that would give a positive light to what was happening here. Well, it was a betrayal, and the result of the program, which was called Gay Power, Gay Politics, was literally a travesty on what was, in fact, happening here and how this wonderful community was coming together around basic issues of civil rights.
Was that in part what led you and others to form the Human Rights Campaign in 1981 as the first LGBT advocacy group on a nationwide basis?
Definitely. The Human Rights Campaign Fund, as it was called, was a political action committee. It was dedicated to raising funds for candidates for federal office who were supportive of LGBT rights. And that was its sole purpose. There were many political action committees at that time. It was a way around campaign finance regulations. And during the first couple of election cycles, that was what the Human Rights Campaign did. Then it got into lobbying and advocacy and into state and local issues and has become the organization it is now.
Unfortunately, we are at the point in our program where we have time for only one last question, so I will ask this question. The future is ours to define. What kind of future would you define for us?
I see a future in which we put aside The petty issues that divide us socially, discover or perhaps rediscover that we have so very many things in common, and proceed to deal with the things which are really the problems of this planet today.
Our thanks to Ambassador James Hormel. And to the wonderful audience here. And Jim, thank you for the privilege of being your moderator tonight.
My pleasure.
This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 105th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.
Thank you.